Chapter 40. Suppose it is because we must act somehow, rightly or wrongly, and there are a great many things which we need not believe unless we choose. As for this old lady, she lived long, long enough, like most of us, to do evil, unlike most of us, long enough to witness some of the results of that evil. To say that is to say that the last years of her life must have been weighted heavily enough with tragic thought. I gave a little shudder of repulsion. That is a depressing view of life, Alan, I said. Does our peace of mind depend only upon death coming early enough to hide from us the truth? And, after all, can it? Our spirits do not die. From another world they may witness the fruits of our lives in this one. If they do, he answered with sudden violence, it is absurd to doubt the existence of a purgatory. There must in such a case be a terrible one in store for the best among us. I was silent. The shadow that lay on his soul did not penetrate to mine, but it hung round me nevertheless, a cloud which I felt powerless to disperse. After a moment he went on, provided that they are distant enough, how little, after all, do we think of the results of our actions? There are few men who would deliberately instill into a child a love of drink, or willfully deprive him of his reason, and yet a man with drunkenness or madness in his blood thinks nothing of bringing children into the world tainted as deeply with the curse, as if he had inoculated them with it directly. There is no responsibility so completely ignored as this one of marriage and fatherhood, and yet how heavy it is and far-reaching. Well, I said, smiling, let us console ourselves with the thought that we are not all lunatics and drunkards. No, he answered. But there are other evils besides these, moral taints as well as physical, curses which have their roots in worlds beyond our own, sins of the fathers which are visited upon the children. He had lost all violence and bitterness of tone now, but the weary dejection which had taken their place communicated itself to my spirit with more subtle power than his previous mood had owned. That is why, he went on, and his manner seemed to give more purpose to his speech than hitherto, that is why, so far as I am concerned, I mean to shirk the responsibility and remain unmarried. I was hardly surprised at his words. I felt that I had expected them, but their utterance seemed to intensify the gloom which rested upon us. Alan was the first to arouse himself from its influence. After all, he said, turning round to me and speaking lightly, without looking so far and so deep, I think my resolve is a prudent one. Above all things, let us take life easily, and you know what St. Paul says about trouble in the flesh, apostrophe a remark which I am sure is specially applicable to briefless barristers, even though possessed of a modest competence of their own. Perhaps one of these days, when I am a fat old judge, I shall give my cook a chance, if she is satisfactory in her clear suits. But till then I shall expect you, Evie, to work me one pair of carpet slippers per annum, as tribute due to a bachelor cousin. I don't quite know what I answered. My heart was heavy and aching, but I tried with true feminine docility to follow the lead he had set me. He continued for some time in the same vein, but as we approached the house the effort seemed to become too much for him, and we relapsed again into silence. This time I was the first to break it. I suppose, I said, drearily, all those horrid people will have come by now. Horrid people, he repeated, with rather an uncertain laugh, and through the darkness I saw his figure bend forward as he stretched out his hand to caress my horse's neck. Why, Evie, I thought you were pining for gaiety, and that it was, in fact, for the purpose of meeting these horrid people that you came here. Yes, I know, I said, wistfully. But somehow the last week has been so pleasant that I cannot believe that anything will ever be quite so nice again. We had arrived at the house as I spoke, and the groom was standing at our horses' heads. Alan got off, and came round to help me to dismount, but instead of putting up his arm as usual as a support for me to spring from, he laid his hand on mine. Yes, Evie, he said, it has been indeed a pleasant time. God bless you for it. For an instant he stood there looking up at me, his face full in the light which streamed from the open door, his gray eyes shining with a radiance which was not wholly from thence. Then he straightened his arm, I sprang to the ground, and as if to preclude the possibility of any answer on my part, he turned sharply on his heel, and began giving some orders to the groom. I went on alone into the house, feeling, I knew not and cared not to know why, that the gloom had fled from my spirit, and that the last ride had not after all been such a melancholy failure as it had bid fair at one time to become. 3. In the hall I was met by the housekeeper, who informed me that, owing to a misunderstanding about dates, a gentleman had arrived whom Lucy had not expected at that time, and that in consequence my room had been changed. My things had been put into the east room, the haunted room, the room of the closed cabinet, as I remembered with a certain sense of pleased importance, though without any surprise. It stood apart from the other guest rooms, at the end of the passage from which opened George and Lucy's private apartment, and as it was consequently disagreeable to have a stranger there, it was always used, when the house was full, for a member of the family. My father and mother had often slept there. There was a little room next to it, though not communicating with it, which served for a dressing room. Though I had never passed the night there myself, I knew it as well as any room in the house. I went there at once, and found Lucy superintending the last arrangements for my comfort. She was full of apologies for the trouble she was giving me. I told her that the apologies were due to my maid, and to her own servants, rather than to me, and besides, I added, glancing round, I am distinctly a gainer by the change. You know, of course, she said, lightly, that this is the haunted room of the house, and that you have no right to be here? I know it is the haunted room, I answered. But why have I no right to be here? Oh, I don't know, she said. There is one of those tiresome Mervyn traditions against allowing unmarried girls to sleep in this room. I believe two girls died in it 150 years ago, or something of that sort. But I should think that people, married or unmarried, must have died in nearly every room in the house, I objected. Oh, yes, of course they have, said Lucy, but once you come across a bit of superstition in this family, it is of no use to ask for reasons. However, this particular bit is too ridiculous even for George. Owing to Mr. Leslie having come today, we must use every room in the house. It is intolerable having a stranger here, and you are the only relation staying with us. I pointed all that out to George, and he agreed that, under the circumstances, it would be absurd not to put you here. I am quite agreeable, I answered. And, indeed, I think I am rather favored in having a room where the last recorded death appears to have taken place 150 years ago. Particularly as I should think that there can be scarcely anything now left in it which was here then, except, of course, the cabinet. The room had, in fact, been entirely done up and refurnished by my uncle, and was as bright and modern-looking an apartment as you could wish to see. It was large, and the walls were covered with one of those white and gold papers which were fashionable 30 years ago. Opposite us, as we stood warming our backs before the fire, was the bed, a large double one, hung with a pretty shade of pale blue. Material of the same color, covered the comfortable modern furniture, and hung from gilded cornices before the two windows which pierced the side of the room on our left. Between them stood the toilet table, all muslin, blue ribbons, and silver. The carpet was a gray and blue Brussels one. The whole effect was cheerful, though I fear inartistic, and sadly out of keeping with the character of the house. The exception to these remarks was, as I had observed, the famous closed cabinet, to which I have more than once alluded. It stood against the same wall of the room as that in which the fireplace was, and on our right, that is, on that side of the fireplace which was farthest from the windows. As I spoke, I turned to go and look at it, and Lucy followed me. Many an hour as a child had I passed in front of it, fingering the seven carved brass handles, or rather buttons, which were ranged down its center. They all slid, twisted, or screwed with the greatest ease, and apparently like many another ingeniously contrived lock, but neither I nor anyone else had ever yet succeeded in sliding, twisting, or screwing them after such a fashion as to open the closed doors of the cabinet. No one yet had robbed them of their secret since first it was placed there 300 years ago by the old lady and her faithful Italian. It was a beautiful piece of workmanship, was this tantalizing cabinet. Carved out of some dark foreign wood, the doors and panels were richly inlaid with lapis lazuli, ivory, and mother of pearl, among which were twisted delicately chased threads of gold and silver. Above the doors, between them and the cornice, lay another mystery, fully as tormenting as was the first. In a smooth strip of wood about an inch wide, and extending along the whole breadth of the cabinet, was inlaid a fine pattern in gold wire. This at first sight seemed to consist of a legend or motto. On looking closer, however, though the pattern still looked as if it was formed out of characters of the alphabet curiously entwined together, you found yourself unable to fix upon any definite word, or even letter. You looked again and again, and the longer that you looked the more certain became your belief that you were on the verge of discovery. If you could approach the mysterious legend from a slightly different point of view, or look at it from another distance, the clue to the puzzle would be seized, and the words would stand forth clear and legible in your sight. But the clue never had been discovered, and the motto, if there was one, remained unread. For a few minutes we stood looking at the cabinet in silence, and then Lucy gave a discontented little sigh. "There's another tiresome piece of superstition," she exclaimed. "By far the handsomest piece of furniture in the house stuck away here in a bedroom which is hardly ever used. Again and again have I asked George to let me have it moved downstairs, but he won't hear of it. Was it not placed here by Dame Alice herself?" I inquired a little reproachfully, for I felt that Lucy was not treating the cabinet with the respect which it really deserved. "Yes, so they say," she answered, and the tone of light contempt in which she spoke was now pierced by a not unnatural pride in the romantic mysteries of her husband's family. "She placed it here, and it is said, you know, that when the closed cabinet is opened, and the mysterious motto is read, the curse will depart from the Mervyn family." "But why don't they break it open?" I asked, impatiently. "I am sure that I would never have remained all my life in a house with a thing like that, and not found out in some way or another what was inside it." "Oh, but that would be quite fatal," answered she. "The curse can only be removed when the cabinet is opened as Dame Alice intended it to be, in an orthodox fashion. If you were to force it open, that could never happen, and the curse would therefore remain forever." "And what is the curse?" I asked, with very different feelings to those with which I had timidly approached the same subject with Alan. Lucy was not a Mervyn, and not a person to inspire awe under any circumstances. My instincts were right again, for she turned away with a slight shrug of her shoulders. "I have no idea," she said. "George and Alan always look portentously solemn and gloomy whenever one mentions the subject, so I don't. If you ask me for the truth, I believe it to be a pure invention, devised by the Mervyns for the purpose of delicately accounting for some of the disreputable actions of their ancestors. For you know, Evie," she added, with a little laugh, "the less said about the character of the family into which your aunt and I have married, the better." The remark made me angry, I don't know why, and I answered stiffly that as far as I was acquainted with them, I at least saw nothing to complain of. "Oh, as regards the present generation, no, except for that poor, wretched Jack," acquiesced Lucy, with her usual imperturbable good humor. "And as regards the next?" I suggested, smiling, and already ashamed of my little temper. "The next is perfect, of course, poor dear boys. She sighed as she spoke, and I wondered whether she was really as unconscious as she generally appeared to be of the strange dissatisfaction with which her husband seemed to regard his children. Anyhow, the mention of them had evidently changed her mood, and almost directly afterwards, with the remark that she must go and look after her guests, who had all arrived by now, she left me to myself. For some minutes I sat by the bright fire, lost in aimless, wandering thought, which began with Dom Alice and her cabinet, and which ended somehow with Alan's face, as I had last seen it looking up at me in front of the hall door. When I had reached that point, I roused myself to decide that I had dreamt long enough, and that it was quite time to go down to the guests and to tea. I accordingly donned my best tea gown, arranged my hair, and proceeded towards the drawing room. My way there lay through the great central hall. This apartment was approached from most of the bedrooms in the house through a large, arched doorway at one end of it, which communicated directly with the great staircase. My bedroom, however, which, as I have said, lay among the private apartments of the house, opened into a passage which led into a broad gallery, or upper chamber, stretching right across the end of the hall. From this you descended by means of a small staircase in oak, whose carved balustrade, bending round the corner of the hall, formed one of the prettiest features of the picturesque old room. The barrier which ran along the front of the gallery was in solid oak, and of such a height that, unless standing close up to it, you could neither see nor be seen by the occupants of the room below. On approaching this gallery I heard voices in the hall. They were George's and Alan's, evidently in hot discussion. As I issued from the passage, George was speaking, and his voice had that exasperated tone in which an angry man tries to bring to a close an argument in which he has lost his temper. "For heaven's sake, leave it alone, Alan. I neither can nor will interfere. We have enough to bear from these cursed traditions as it is, without adding one which has no foundation whatever to justify it, a mere contemptible piece of superstition. No member of our family has a right to call any tradition contemptible which is connected with that place, and you know it." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.